Here in the third hour of Issues Etc., Dr. Alvin Schmidt joins us. We're going to be talking for this final hour about polytheism and American civil religion. Now, those are two things you might not readily associate with one another. You think of polytheism as something of the ancient world, or at the very least, the primitive and pagan world. And you think of American civil religion, well, you got images of flags flying, and presidents blessing us all in God's name, and those kinds of things. What could the two have in common? How could the two find common ground in the naked public square? We're going to be talking about that here in the last hour of Issues Etc. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. Feel free to join us as the conversation continues. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He is author of several books, including How Christianity Changed the World. And he's also written a chapter in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, The Anonymous God. His chapter is titled Polytheism, the New Face of American Civil Religion. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back again. Thank you.
Before we get to the issue of polytheism in American civil religion, I know that there's an issue that is related to it and helpful for understanding it that you have some expertise in, and that is multiculturalism and American civil religion. What do the two have to do with one another nowadays?
Well, in the American context, civil religion, of course, is much older than promoting multiculturalism, which has been going on for the last 20 years or so. Civil religion harks in our society back to the early Puritans, actually, 1630. And the concept was even coined earlier than that by Jacques Rousseau, the French philosopher. That's where the term actually comes from. And Americans have been very civil religiously oriented over the years, initially for about 150 years with the Puritans. It had basically a Christian aura. They were going to make the Shining Hill, America, the Shining Hill on the, for the nation, showing how Christianity is going to be incorporated into government and national life. Then after about mid-1700s or so, it became deistic. Namely, the Christian emphasis was basically lost, and now deistic, namely believing only in a supreme being who was never really defined. And then more recently, within the last 20 years or so, it moved another direction into polytheism, where now all sorts of gods were put on the same level. And to back to your question of multiculturalism, it fits in very well with multiculturalism, because multiculturalism is an ideology that argues that all cultures are essentially equal. Now, when you look at the different religions, the different that worship different gods, whether it's Hinduism or whether it's Islam or whether it's the Sikh religion or Buddhism, all different religions fits in very well with multiculturalism, because they too then are seen as essentially equal, and that's basically where we are today. So multiculturalism, in a sense, gives further emphasis and impetus even to polytheism, which ultimately is a new form of paganism.
So let me see if I can see the connection there as you've explained it. If religion as a phenomenon, not any particular religion, but if religion is merely a cultural artifact, and if all cultures are on an equal footing in the world, as multiculturalism would assert, then it would stand to reason, just as various forms of dress that are cultural artifacts should not be considered superior to others. So religion, if it's a mere cultural artifact, they all have to be equal.
That's exactly where we are today.
So it really has more to say about the relationship between religion and culture.
Yes.
Than anything.
That's right. And this is the message that we get via the television and via the newspapers and via the radios in many, many instances. And this is why if you or I, as Orthodox Christians, would disagree and do disagree, we would be seen as narrow-minded or worse, bigoted.
So it's a very thin line. One thing I noted in about the last 4 years in our nation, that to declare or to assert that any one religion is patently false or that any one religion is patently true almost has the same kind of ring to it in the culture's ears as someone making some sort of racial epithet.
Yeah, very much so. It's as much as we hear in multiculturalism to be tolerant, that's one thing that is not tolerated. Namely, that you can say, as the Bible says, as Christ said, there was no other religion that was valid. When he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no man comes to the Father but by me, or when Peter preached in his Pentecostal sermon, neither is there salvation in any other, for there's no other name given under heaven among men whereby we must be saved. That, of course, got the early Christians in trouble in the context of Roman polytheism, and it's getting Christians today in trouble in our new polytheism. And so, therefore, I titled this particular chapter, Polytheism is the New Face of Civil Religion.
Now, take us back through the history. You gave us a very brief run-through of American civil religion, but explain to us what it was according to Christian roots. You say at first it had its roots in Christianity. It then, very early in American history, became deist and now is polytheistic. Let's go into more detail, beginning with Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the man who coined this term.
Yes, Rousseau, of course, was a, well, he was basically an atheist or agnostic or irreligious. But when we're talking about American civil religion, you can see some similarities. Rousseau wanted to have civil religion basically in a pagan context. It would function and serve as uniting the nation with its values and that religion and its national values apart from Christianity. But it never really took off, so to speak, in France where he lived. But then when we move to the American scene with the Puritans in 1630, they brought to the scene, and I don't know how much they knew about Rousseau, probably not much or if anything, but they took Christian values in and tried to make them part of the national values and have the shining city on a hill, which is one of the phrases that they used and tried to implement and did in many ways. In early stages of American civil religion were basically had a large Christian aura. But in time, about 150 years later, that sort of disappeared and it became, as I said a little while ago, deistic. It no longer had any Christian connotations. It was just believing in a God as a supreme being. And we see that in the founding fathers, then in the 1700s, at the time of the American Revolution and time of the formation of the American Constitution, when, for example, even Washington would refer to God as the Almighty, the Creator, the our Maker, Supreme Being, and similarly, you would see that kind of phrase or hear that kind of phrase on the part of Benjamin Franklin, another pronounced deist, and that then was partly also reinforced, as I mentioned in the book, in this chapter rather, with the large influence that these individuals, many of our founding fathers, had because they were Freemasons. Freemason is a deistic organization. It obviously it does not accept Jesus Christ as the only acceptable God. And so there was a reciprocity there between Freemasonry and deism, and that basically functioned. You know, if you listen to civil religious events in our day and age, and whether it's Memorial Day or whether it's the 4th of July or whether it's Thanksgiving Day, and these are all sort of national civil religious events in our society, you will never hear the word Christ. It is simply, if God is mentioned, it'll be God or it'll be the divine being or the supreme maker or something to that effect.
To pause at that moment in history for a second, Dr. Schmidt, and ask, there are those who will go back to the to the colonial documents of history, to the early commonwealths, to the Puritan fathers, and perhaps even to some of the writers outside of that circle, and will say, look, the American civil religion was very strongly Christian in its tenor, and that's what it still is today, and that's what it was during the time of the Revolution. They are simply ignoring the fact that by the time the nation is really underway officially, it has become a deistic enterprise. Whether or not the founders were deists or not, American civil religion took on the characteristics of yes. deism.
Yes, very, very much so. By the time of the American Revolution, you do not find in civil religious ceremonies, events, and the like, anything that's distinctively Christian. That is lost by the mid-1700s.
All right. Again, to pause, because so many of the artifacts of civil religion at that time are still with us today. You mm-hmm. say that American civil religion, it is a religion, as you've already said, that uses the generic terms for God. It makes no mention of heaven or hell, or as you have most mm-hmm. rightly pointed out, Christ.
Mm-hmm.
You say it has its own holy days.
Yes, and it has its own shrines. The Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, the Jefferson Memorial are basically, I was just in D.C. 10 days ago, and the masses of people that go to these places, you know, and this is not original to me. Many analysts in the sociological context have talked about civil religion in this country, and they have often referred to these national symbols as we have them, like I said, the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, the Jefferson Memorial, and the like, are basically a type of religious shrine for us in the context of civil religion. We see these shrines not divorced from God, but as part of the divine guidance of America through the ages, you know. And it's interesting when at the time of the American Revolution, the Continental Congress, before the present Constitution was in operation, in 1776, for example, and the like, assigned several men to design a great seal. And what even Jefferson and Franklin, they designed a great seal, for example, with one was Moses lifting his wand, dividing the Red Sea, and it was, in other words, America was the new promised land, and they saw analogies to Moses taking the people of Israel out of Egypt into the promised land. Likewise, now as the Puritans came from Europe, they were brought to this new promised land. And this is part of the American civil religion, and they try to incorporate it in a Great Seal. It never became part of the Great Seal, but I have pictures of this, and I've given talks on it, showing exactly what they did draw. With the water there, and as it happens in the Old Testament, with Pharaoh, who came with his soldiers, wanted to get his children of Israel to come back, and then, of course, they got across, and Pharaoh and his soldiers got drowned. They tried to depict this and wanted to make it part of the Great Seal of the nation, depicting thereby that this country was the new promised land as Israel or Canaan was way back at the time of Moses.
I was talking with a friend a couple weekends back. He and his family had just taken a long road trip, and they had passed through our nation's capital, through Washington, D.C., seeing just about everything there was to see there, including, and he had pictures they were showing us, the Library of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, walking into that building, it struck him how much like a church it
mm-hmm.
was.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, how he said it couldn't have been accidental.
No.
It has every trapping of a church, including an altar upon which sits the founding documents of our nation. This use of religious language, symbol, and even architecture a conscious effort on the part of the people who built these buildings, these shrines, these memorials to American civil religion?
I think so. I really do. I would say probably for most people, yes. The designers, yes. I think they were. Some may not have been conscious of them. But, you know, when you talk about an altar, again, you also see not only the church-like emphasis here, but you see in every Masonic lodge, there is an altar in the center of the lodge room. So again, the two sort of complemented each other and became a part of the American civil religion scene. And so I'd say yes.
You also say that American civil religion, from the time of the nation was formally founded, also had its own saints. Who are you talking about?
Well, Washington is one of our saints, if you will. Lincoln is one of our saints. Jefferson is one of our saints. These are men that we look up to, like people who, in many instances, wrongly so in the Christian church, pray to saints. We don't necessarily pray to saints, to them as saints, but they remind you of saint-like qualities, or people see them in that context. And again, this is not original to me. There have been many analysts that have said this, and I think it's a valid observation.
So it was not too long, in fact, even before the founding of the American nation, that the civil religious enterprise became explicitly deistic, that is, a distant God, nothing more than an almighty creator, not judge, certainly not savior in any sense, not Trinitarian, but a detached and kind of passive God. When does American civil religion begin to become polytheistic?
I'd say sort of around 1980, in the 80s, 20, 25 years ago, when multiculturalism began to really take root. And that was in the 80s. You find beginnings of it sort of, but still very, very rudimentary, at the end of the Vietnam War and the like, but it began to take hold in the 1980s. Multiculturalism. In fact, if you look, and I did this some time ago, in the late 1980s, you couldn't even find multiculturalism in the literature index in any publications as a term. But now you find it all over the place. And you know, for the longest, I wrote published a book in 1997. Multiculturalism, the menace of multiculturalism, Trojan horse in America. Even at that time, a lot of people still were not very much aware of it. And even today, there's still a lot of misunderstanding. A lot of people think multiculturalism, refers to learning about other cultures. That's not what multiculturalism is at all. Multiculturalism is an ideology, as I said earlier. It says all cultures are essentially equal, regardless of what they do, and you can't condemn any. They are only different, but not any of them that is superior or inferior. And that has taken really hold now in our schools. You see it, for example, in textbook, or take a complementary term, if you will, political correctness. Political correctness is a multicultural phenomenon. Meaning for, and it permeates our textbooks today in grade school and high school. It distorts history. History has been revised in terms of political correct values, whether they're true or not, or much of it, for example, often, sometimes Harriet Tubman gets more treatment, longer discussions in a history book than does George Washington. So you see, that's the political correct. It's also sometimes kind of a feel-good history. When we try to say something about certain minority groups relative even to the founding of our country, for example, the argument was made a number of years ago that the Iroquois up in the northeast basically influenced the formation of the American Constitution. This is totally off the wall, but you find it now in almost every high school history book. For a while, it was only confined to the history books in New York. Now it's almost across the nation. I document that in my book already in 1997. And so you see, again, to lift up other cultures, and multiculturalism never points out the evils of another culture. For example, we'll never mention that most of the American Indians, long before Columbus set foot on this soil, practiced slavery. This is not a monopoly of the Western world, or of Europe, if you will, or, for example, they will never tell you when they talk about the Aztecs of the bloodletting practices they did, tear people's hearts out and the like. That's never in textbook because it's not politically correct. And so that reinforces multiculturalist values, and this is what our children today in schools learn. I was at a conference some time ago in Iowa in a school, high school, and I said, just give me any textbook at random, and I'll quickly show you, whether it's a geography book or a history book or an English book, I'll show you the political correctness that will be found here and there. And it is very, very easy. But the problem is, a lot of our people are not aware of that. And so they read that the American Indians made contributions to the American Constitution, the kids walk away believing it's true, and the teachers don't know that it's not true either.
Let's talk with Steve, who calls from his car, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Steve, welcome to Issues Etc.
Observation and a question. My observation is that many American Christians have replaced the traditional creed with the new American creed, and I think that's what we can call the Pledge of Allegiance, because
yes.
How many Christians do you know get bent out of shape that the creeds have been taken out of the churches, but if you start trying to take God out of the Pledge of Allegiance, they just raise all kinds of havoc.
It's a good observation, Steve. Thank you very much. What do you make of it, Dr. Schmidt?
Yeah, he's basically right. And in many ways, what I'm about to say may not be favorable to many of our hearers, but the Pledge of Allegiance is basically a kind of civil religious utterance, in that God, again, is not defined, and he can be seen as whatever you like him to be. And that fits perfectly well into civil religion. Now, you can argue that this is functional, that it has some values. Of course, that's the civil religion argument that Rousseau posed before. But, you know, Christians, I'm not saying they're sinning when they say the Pledge of Allegiance, but they have to be aware of that this is not Christian theology they're uttering.
And if they recognize, I mean, there are other ways they can err in this respect, that is to say, one nation under God, as though the other nations are somehow on God's wrong side, and America has most favored nation status with God.
Yeah. I basically agree to that. I don't think, that's exactly civil religion, again, a part of it. We are very much favored by God as a nation. And, well, historically speaking, God did favor this nation for a long time, and to some extent still does. But our credit may be running out pretty soon, given the way we today have moved, for example, even in the context of civil religion, to polytheism, where, for example, we no longer want any kind of Christian symbols conveyed, like taking down the cross in civic monuments or wherever they might be, or in some other form. We're losing it in that sense. And, you know, it's interesting. The Christians in China are praying that American Christians would begin to be persecuted so that true Christianity would come to the fore again. And that's quite a statement. But our mutual friend, Ed Veith, mentions this in his recent cultural column in World Magazine.
With less than a minute here, Dr. Schmidt, begin an answer. What is, to come back to multiculturalism, what is multiculturalism's view and attitude toward those cultures that are, as you have argued so well, the product of Christianity's influence, in particular Western culture?
Well, multiculturalism, a good case in point is what's going on in the European Union, where the Constitution of the European Union totally ignores any kind of reference to Europe's Christian influence. An excellent book that was published only a couple of months ago by George Weigel, The Cube and the Cathedral, where he talks about this phenomenon. And in other words, multiculturalism, political correctness has become so strong that they don't want to make any reference in the European Union Constitution to Christianity because it might offend someone who isn't a Christian, but there's more to it. There is also the belief on the part of the people who formed this document that they have disowned or de-Christianized Europe, if you will.
Let's come back to that when we come back from this break. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. He's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, author of several books, including How Christianity Changed the World. And he's authored this chapter in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August, Polytheism, the New Face of American Civil Religion.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Why do even Christian politicians in America feel free to use the word God, but seem afraid to use the name Jesus. How are we to understand big, popular, interreligious prayer services? What are the tensions between the God of American civil religion and the God that Christians worship? Can Christians be satisfied with a blurring of the distinction between these two? The Anonymous God is the name of Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August. This book is $16.99. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. This book is edited by two Issues, Etc. regular guests, Dr. David Adams and Dr. Ken Sherb. You can also call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for The Anonymous God, The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
Old Earthers, can they be Christians?
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the book on why God allows death and suffering, called Walking Through Shadows, Finding Hope in a World of Pain. Well, Ken, I know you insist that the Bible teaches that the earth is only thousands of years old, but if people believe in billions of years, can they still be Christians?
On a live radio talk show, a man called up once and he said, "I object to the way you say that people have to believe in a young earth to be a Christian." Well, I immediately replied, "Sir, I've never said that. If people are born again as the Bible defines, no matter what they believe about the age of the earth, they're saved." This man then went on and said, "Well, do you recognize that it doesn't matter what you believe about the earth's age?" I then stated, "Now, wait a minute. I didn't say that. You see, ultimately, it does matter what you believe about the age of the earth. One of the reasons is that as soon as you allow for billions of years, you've also allowed death, suffering, bloodshed, and disease before sin. The Bible teaches that death is a penalty for sin. It's the foundation of the gospel." I went on to explain to him that if you're a Christian and believe in an old earth, that won't stop you from getting to heaven, but it will stop you from correctly understanding the foundation of the gospel message.
One of our witnessing booklets answers the question of why God allows death and suffering in our world. You can read Ken Ham's free booklet when you visit our attractive and easy-to-use website, AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Medium Minute. Let your conscience be your guide, so the saying goes. But in order for our conscience to know right from wrong, it has to be trained. As the conscience of our children develop in their formative years, the stories they hear and the lessons they learn will have a great influence on them. Too many children today are having their conscience trained by sitcoms and reality shows. In a study of prison inmates convicted of violent crimes, 33% said they intentionally copied the criminal activity they saw on TV. Remind your children that Christ died for us and He has given us the Bible so that our conscience could be guided by His Word. Only then can we let our conscience be our guide. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Science seems to be moving at breakneck speed. How can Christians make ethical decisions on issues like stem cell research, abortion, and euthanasia? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, inviting you to join us for the Image of God Bioethics Conference, Friday, November the 11th at the Sheraton Westport Lakeside Chalet in St. Louis. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. regular guest Wesley Smith is one of the featured speakers. The Image of God Bioethics Conference, November the 11th in St. Louis. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. We're talking about polytheism and American civil religion. We invite your questions and your comments. 25 minutes left in this conversation. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Schmidt has written a chapter in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for August called The Anonymous God. His chapter is titled Polytheism, the New Face of American Civil Religion. And Dr. Schmidt is just one of many Issues Etc. regular guests who contribute to this book: Dr. David Adams, Dr. Cameron McKenzie, Ken Sherb, Joel Okamoto, Dr. Ron Feuerhahn, he was just with us yesterday, and Pastor Mark Sell, all regular guests here on Issues Etc., all contributors among the others. to our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August, The Anonymous God, The Church Confronts Civil Religion and American Society. It's edited by Dr. Sherb and Dr. Adams. It's $16.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, when you get home tonight, go to our website. You'll find this book, The Anonymous God, issuesetc.org. Or tomorrow, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Mention the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for August, The Anonymous God. Dr. Schmidt, you were talking about the view that multiculturalism takes of cultures that are the product largely of Christian influence, not Christian cultures per se, but the product of Christian influence, and you were mentioning the new European Union Constitution. Is this typical of how multiculturalism views anything that has kind of the even the fingerprint of Christianity upon it?
Very much so. This is why it's so silly or ridiculous for multiculturalism to claim it's tolerant. It is tolerant for any and every religion except Christianity. And wherever possible, it will omit it, and sometimes even if it doesn't omit it, make very negative comments about it, and many or exaggerate some of the things that have happened over the years in Western society, which they often like to link with Christian influence. And so, yes, very definitely so. There is another phenomenon that I may mention that I mentioned in this particular chapter, that we have, in a sense, all sort of bought into in recent years, namely where we equate faith with religion.
Yeah, I was interested by that section of your chapter. Tell us about it.
Yes. Equating faith with religion, as I argue here, is a no-no to Christians because it slights Christianity. First of all, one of the things that I discovered when I did my research for how Christianity changed the world, when I looked at the Greek and the Roman writings, that the word fide, faith, was never used with religious connotations. That came to me as a big shock, and I document this in this particular chapter. The word faith, as a synonym to religion, is a Christian innovation that comes basically with St. Paul, where he talks about people falling, or, I mean, being added to the faith and the like. I cite a number of references, for example, out of Acts and Galatians and Timothy and Titus. The pagans, Romans, did not use fide as a synonym to religion. That was a Christian innovation. And so today, we have people from our president on down speaking of people of faith, talking about people of religious beliefs. You see how the word faith, now a distinctively Christian meaning, now is linked and equated with religion. I tell people in Bible classes and other contexts, and I'm about to say it now, as Christians, we should never speak about the Muslim faith, the Buddhist faith, or the Hindu faith, but the Muslim religion, the Buddhist religion. Faith is an exclusively Christian term, and when we use that to them, and there's another big danger here. Today, faith is understood, and I'm afraid even among many of our own people, believing in something for which there is no evidence. That's not faith. That's not biblical faith. For example, we believe, as Lutherans have always taught, that faith consists of three elements. We've not done a good job of communicating this. Notitia is the Latin word for knowledge. It consists of knowledge that happened in this world. Then it consists of assent, giving assent and meaning, assent to what this event did, and then trust. Fiducia is the Latin word. Now, our society simply sees faith as believing something for which there is no evidence. That's not faith. It's the absence of faith. And when Christians sort of go along with this, they're saying that Christianity is no more credible than Islam or Buddhism or Sikhism or whatever else you have. The Christians, too, believe in something for which there is no evidence. No. The New Testament is very clear. We are eyewitnesses of His Majesty. We have touched Him. We have handled Him and seen. And the best example of all is the Doubting Thomas selection. He told his fellow disciples, his colleagues, I'm not going to believe in this, and he told them this over a period of a week, unless I can put my fingers into his wounds. And Christ did not come to him and say, Thomas, you should simply believe. You don't need any evidence. No, he gave him the evidence, and then what happened? When he encountered Jesus Christ, the risen Lord, and saw the wounds, felt him, he said, my Lord and my God. You see, that was an expression of faith. But faith does not make the resurrection true or valid any more than it does the existence of Constantine or the Great or George Washington. I point out, it's the historical veracity of the resurrection that makes the Christian faith valid. It is not my faith that makes the resurrection valid or true. And this is where we have a great deal. I remember when I talked to Bible, because this perks up people's ears, because they have this understanding that faith is believing in something for which there is no evidence. And we as Christians have to be very, very vocal, very, very clear and adamant about it. That's not faith. The New Testament constantly talks about, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, if you don't believe that he rose from the dead, there are some 500 people alive. Go ask them. He was again appealing to knowledge, notitia, the Latins would say. And then, as you encounter this, there comes the element of faith. Faith is the benefit we derive from the historical event that happened. It is not that which establishes the event.
When we hear, and this is so common nowadays, when we hear a politician or a lawmaker, or a public figure, or even a public religious leader, mm-hmm. refer to the many faiths represented in the American population. You are saying that this has the effect of drawing an equivalency between all of them, not only in terms of their historicity, but in terms of their truthfulness.
Exactly. And I can't make, as far as I know, I'm the first one, and I don't want to say this in any modest way, first one to really draw attention to this. And I have a book that's coming out that CPH will be published, I signed a contract recently, where I have a whole chapter devoted to this understanding of faith and the like. And what I'm seeing is not anything new. The New Testament is filled with that kind of thing. Quenchstedt, a 17th century Lutheran theologian, argued, for example, that faith consisted of those three elements that I mentioned a little while ago, knowledge, assent, and trust. And then we have a modern-day German theologian by the name of Pannenberg, who has argued in the same length. He says, mere knowledge of God's revelation does not yet make one a participant in salvation included therein. Only when a man relies upon this, in him trustingly takes the ground on which he stands, receives that in that. And then he goes on to say, salvation is only received as an act of trust. And again, he argues for the historicity of the resurrection, that this has to be true. It is not a faith event. It is the resurrection produces faith, but faith does not make the resurrection.
You talked before in passing about the Masonic influence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as I understand, and I have very cursory understanding of the Masonic temples and organizations, but I know you have some expertise on it. Was Masonry at the time it was influencing American civil religion, was it already essentially a polytheistic or what would we call it now, all roads lead to God kind of a viewpoint?
In essence, yes. It wasn't very widespread and pronounced. But Masonry is always, from 1723 at least, when they revised the whole constitution back in England, accepted all religions. For example, if you are in a Hindu environment, you have the Veda at the altar. In this country, it would be a Bible. If you're in a Mormon territory, it would be the Book of Mormon. If you are, for example, in a Muslim country, the Quran is put on the Masonic altar. So in essence, they have given, what shall I say, impetus, even grounded, you might say, the idea of polytheism thereby.
So even as American civil religion is transitioning from its Christian roots to a deistic tenor, already the seeds are being planted for the future of a polytheistic American civil religion.
Oh, yes, and I argue it's already here.
Now, then I got to wonder this, because one might argue that Christianity and deism could somehow coexist as long as one does not examine the other too carefully. But it's hard to make a case that polytheism and Christianity can coexist in any real sense, even without anything beyond a cursory examination. It sounds as though American civil religion, if it is polytheistic, has become polytheistic, is then openly hostile to Christianity. When then will Christians realize that this hostility exists?
That's a very good question. You see, whether they can coexist, I don't think very long that they could coexist. First of all, if Christians aren't too aware of it, they'll be taken in by it and become polytheistically oriented. The Yankee Stadium affair is an example of civil religion in a polytheistic context. I can think of no better example.
How so? Explain that.
Well, you had Islamic individual, you had a Hindu there, you had a Sikh there, to my knowledge, you had Christians there, all praying to their own God. And this is very similar to what the Romans did when Christianity was persecuted for saying, no, we're not going to participate in these kind of events. You know, the early Christians wouldn't even take an innocuous-looking drop of oil and drop it on either an pagan altar or, for example, on something else that represented the emperor, who was often deified. No, they would not. And the Romans were all too eager to add the figure of Christ in the pantheon of Rome, where they had all the different gods, the buildings still there to this day. The Christians says no, they would not give in. And by the way, in roughly 300 years, they essentially turned the world upside down by not taking part in polytheistic civil religion, because Roman religion was very civil religious.
So what are the other dangers of this multicultural, then now polytheistic American civil religion, beyond Christians unwittingly being involved in it and being drawn into either a participation in or even the presuppositions of polytheism? What are the other dangers?
Well, one of the things that we as Christians need to do more of is to mention the name of Christ a lot more than we do. I sometimes tell pastors and teachers when I talk to different groups, we should, you know, and here's a good example of St. Paul, good example of Luther. Not that what I'm about to say is wrong, but it's not complete. We often pray and say, at the end of the prayer, when we ask this in Jesus' name. Now, it's not wrong, but it's not complete. Why couldn't we say, in Jesus Christ's name, or in Christ's name? You see, as I sometimes say, many Americans believe, and there was a survey done a few years ago, that the name Christ was Jesus' family name, and Jesus was simply his first name. And again, showing that they have, many Americans have no understanding of Jesus Christ at all. And there's also this to be reckoned with. In 2001, I think, the Barna Research Group, that religious research group, found that 60% of American Christians no longer believe that Christ was sinless. Now, that's shocking. When I was a PhD student at the University of Nebraska, my advisor was an atheist, but even he believed that Christ was sinless. Now, 60% of Christians no longer do. So there is this polytheistic multiculturalism influence that is seeping into our pews. And you have probably in every congregation of any size a number of people who would agree that Christ was not totally sinless. So there's one effect there that we as Christians need to underscore, that Christ was sinless. And I like, for example, when you look at St. Paul's epistles, at the beginning or at the end, particularly at the beginning, he always talks about Jesus Christ. One could even say that Arius, the heretic in the early 4th century who denied the deity and the divinity of Christ, didn't have much trouble with Jesus, but he had an awful lot of trouble with the word Christ. Because that emphasized that Jesus was the Messiah, he was divine, he was the Son of God. And I tend to think that we have been influenced by our culture. When we listen to the televangelists, listen, rarely do they say Jesus Christ. It's always just Jesus, 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 Jesus. Now again, for not wanting to be misunderstood, I'm not saying it's wrong, but it's not as complete as it could be. And so let's bring that in. And because Jesus then is seen frequently just as a man, but I think when we emphasize the meaning of Christ, which comes from the Greek word meaning Messiah, it adds a special dimension to what Christ was, namely the promised one predicted in the Old Testament, who would come, suffer, die, and rise from the dead for the sins of the world. And I think we need to make more emphasis of that.
You say that there are two ingredients missing from American civil religion that now, in the 21st century, very clearly sets it apart in every respect from Orthodox Christianity.
Right.
Unconditional gospel, and as you've just been talking about, to some degree, Christ alone. First, talk about mm-hmm. this notion of an unconditional gospel.
Yes, that there is nothing I can do to be saved, to be accepted by God for my salvation. It is by grace alone, if Paul says in Romans 3:27. If it is by grace, it's no longer of works. Or as he says in Ephesians, by grace you have been saved, not of works, lest any man should boast. And, you know, this is what we as Lutherans have always said from the time of the Reformation, sola fide, faith alone. And that is what Paul said. This is what we have said. And of course, there are a lot of Christians to this day who still believe it's faith and works. No, it is not. It is faith alone in Jesus Christ. Now, this is why, for example, in my upcoming book that I mentioned, I start off with the first chapter called Solus Christus. You know, it's been a little surprising to me that in our Lutheran context, particularly the Reformation time, we often have three solas, right? Sola Scriptura, sola gratia, sola fide. And the fourth one is missing. Now, the other three don't mean anything without Solus Christus. Solus Christus meaning Christ alone. There is no salvation outside of him. As earlier I said, you know, when Christ said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh to the Father but by me. And all our theology is always Christ-centered, or as Luther put it, the Bible is the cradle of Christ. And that we need to emphasize. We don't hear that on television evangelist programs. No, I believe in the Bible because of Jesus Christ, not the other way around. And that's been a distinctively Lutheran biblical emphasis, but we don't make too much noise about it, I'm afraid.
And if the Christian is going to interact with American civil religion, and there's hardly any way that you can't, at least accidentally, interact with it, open our eyes here with about another 2 or 3 minutes so that we can see clearly, for instance, what is meant when someone utters the words under God. What God are they talking about? Remove a kind of the naivete that so much attaches itself to the Christian with regard to this subject.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never seen a study what the average person understands by when you say one nation under God. I assume that a seriously minded, biblically believing Christian sees it in the context of the triune God, although I wouldn't want to bet on it that most Christians do, because we often haven't defined God very well. We kind of leave that sort of almost take it for granted, like the concept of faith. We have really not done much defining about what faith consists of. And that's why, for example, we have people today, as I said earlier, defining faith as believing in something for which there is no evidence. Well, Christians have to be appalled when they hear that, but 9 times out of 10, I don't think they would be. And it's not necessarily their fault. It's been the fault, I suppose, of us as pastors who have not made enough of that. And maybe in the past, when civil religion and all these things weren't brought into your living room via television, it was perhaps less of a problem. But today, this is visible to a lot of people, and they're influenced by it. And they tend to think, for example, this is synonymous with Christianity. It is not. And for us to say that, again, will not make us popular. Christianity never has been popular, primarily because it has always stood on Solus Christus. Christ alone. And you're not going to, you know, bring in other gods into the pantheon, whether it's American civil religion or going back 2,000 years ago in the Roman pantheon in Rome.
You know, it strikes me that nowadays Christians are up in arms about getting the Ten Commandments mm-hmm. back into the public square. And I must wonder, as I often have to myself, if you succeed in doing this, and you say, look, this is just the foundation for our laws, and it's a code upon which all religions can agree. Have you really brought the true God back into the public square?
No, you haven't. And you see, this is why I personally don't get excited about the fact that we want to have prayers in public schools. Well, who's going to be prayed to? It's not going to be the triune God, I bet you. And I don't want my kids, if I'm a parent, exposed to this polytheistic, generic concept of God as equivalent or equal to the Trinitarian Christian God as presented in the Bible.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College. He's author of several books, including How Christianity Changed the World, and he's also written a chapter in our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August, The Anonymous God. His chapter is titled Polytheism, the New Face of American Civil Religion. Dr. Schmidt, it is always a pleasure, and I was very gratified to find your chapter here in this book. I talked with one of the editors earlier today, and he said he was very glad to have it in there as well. It made a unique contribution. Thank you very much for being our guest.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I mentioned this before, but I got to mention it again, because there could be no more pressing issue for Christians as they try to engage the culture and civil society than our Issues, Etc. book of the month for August, The Anonymous God, The Church Confronts Civil Religion and American Society. It is $16.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, just go to our website. You'll find the book there at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House. Call them tomorrow, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for The Anonymous God. Mention Issues, Etc., 1-800-325-3040. Tomorrow on the program, Preaching Christ Crucified with Dr. Carl Fikencher of Concordia Theological Seminary. Earlier today, we talked with Father Matushak, and it was unclear that Christ Crucified was anything more than an example for Christians in spiritual blindness. Well, we'll be talking about what it really means to preach Christ and Him crucified tomorrow on Issues, Etc. Then Sunday night, Eastern Orthodoxy is the subject. Craig Parton and Dr. Martin Noland will be our guests. That's live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Tune in for that program on Sunday night. We cannot afford to be naive. Not about, well, to wrap this all up, not about something like Eastern Orthodoxy, where we hear what we want to hear, what we hope to hear, what we wish could be true, when our brothers from the East talk to us. We cannot afford to be naive when we hear uttered in the public square, under God, in God we trust, God bless America, and hear only what we want to hear, what we hope to hear, what we wish were true. Wishing doesn't make it so. We have to deal with the world and the church where God has put us. I think it is Dietrich Bonhoeffer who warns us against hopeful wishing or visionary dreaming. He says God hates visionary dreaming. We deal with our neighbor, our church, our society as it is, and we confront it with the Word of God, whatever that might mean, and wherever the chips may fall. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.